From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. This is Idaho Matters. Thanks for joining us today. You know about COVID-19 and the effect it has had on the globe, but what about the other coronaviruses out there? Turns out there are more of them than you might think, and some of them are not very nice. And has everyone had COVID yet? Some people think so, but that might not be the case. Joining us today to answer these questions is Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. And if you have a public health question, send us an email right now, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. And if you send it right now, Dr. Pate can answer it during the show. Dr. Pate, as always, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, you're welcome. Hi, Samantha.
Hi there. Okay, you have been writing like crazy on your blog. you must not sleep.
Right.
Yeah. You wrote this week about how many hospitals may regret their decision to relax COVID precautions. I thought this was a fascinating article, and I'm going to ask why. Why will hospitals regret it?
Yeah, I think there's two very recent studies that just came out in the last week that shed light of some of the concerns that I first expressed when I heard that a number of hospitals were making this move of recent to relax their precautions. And those two concerns were, number one, how are they going to protect patients? Because obviously the people that end up in the hospital are not usually and primarily are healthiest, or are, and they tend to be either very, very young, like infants that we have in the neonatal intensive care unit, or much older, which are both high risk groups. So would relaxing these precautions put those people at greater risk? And I suggested it would. Well, now we have a study that was just came out a couple of days ago, and it looked at England and Scotland, where they actually allowed their hospitals to stop routine testing. So most of us that have had an experience with being admitted to a hospital or having a family member admitted to the hospital over the last 3 years know that everybody's been tested to see if they might have COVID. And that makes sense because we know a lot of people don't have symptoms at first, or may have symptoms they don't recognize as being COVID. And if they're in the hospital, then they're going to be contagious and affect the staff and other patients. So they looked at, well, what happened in England and Scotland when they stopped doing this at last fall. And what they found was a very striking increase, relative increase in the number of hospital-acquired COVID infections. So what we mean there is somebody didn't get admitted to the hospital with COVID, but a week later, they had evidence of COVID suggesting they got it in the hospital. And what we saw was that in England, there was a 26% relative increase in the number of patients that didn't go in with COVID but ended up getting COVID. And in Scotland, it was 41% increase, meaning that these steps that we take where we're not being careful, identifying those with COVID, using precautions to prevent spread of infections, it results in spread of infections in hospitals. And in fact, in both countries, the rate of increase of cases was highest within the hospitals compared to the community. So the hospitals were a more dangerous place to go. The second concern that I had was for the welfare of our healthcare workers. We all know that we have shortages of nurses, shortages of technologists, shortages of physicians. And so what happens when healthcare professionals get infected with COVID, which They can certainly do outside of work, but they can also certainly be at risk in the hospital. And so we had a study come out that looked at healthcare workers from a health system in Brazil. And these were healthcare workers that worked between the very beginning of the pandemic and July of last year. And they looked at all of the healthcare workers that got COVID, and then they divided them into the group that had long COVID, as it's defined by the CDC, and those that did not have long COVID. And what they found was really startling. We don't have certainty, but we believe that the frequency of people getting long COVID in our general population is around 10 to 12%. In other words, about 1 in 10 people that gets COVID may end up with long COVID. What they found in these healthcare workers is the risk was 27.4%. In other words, more than double the risk. And that kind of makes sense because, first of all, when you're in a hospital setting, you're getting exposed to people when they're really sick. You're doing things to them that might result in you breathing in the virus. And you might get a higher load because you're with these patients quite a bit. And all of these things can produce problems. And so what they found when they looked at the group that got COVID is the ones that were at highest risk of getting long COVID were those that had two or more infections. And if that happened, their risks went up. On the other hand, those healthcare workers who had four doses of the COVID vaccine had a significantly reduced chance of developing long COVID. So it's more evidence that really supports the common sense notion that when we're in a pandemic with a highly contagious, highly transmissible respiratory virus, we ought to protect patients and we ought to protect our healthcare workers.
Well, and some of those numbers are pretty striking. I mean, in the first group where there was such a higher chance of catching COVID in the hospital in Scotland, as you said, the folks who go into the hospital are usually sick or maybe immunosuppressed or just at a higher chance of catching it to begin with because of their health. And then, you know, it's just amazing. And then when you're talking about the healthcare workers, 27%, that's, ugh.
Yeah, it was really quite startling to many of us. And I think to your earlier point, Samantha, when you talk about these high-risk people that are in the hospital, realize that the mortality rate, if you catch COVID in the hospital, given that it tends to be exactly the people that you said, older people, infants, people that are immunocompromised, those kind of things, the mortality rate is multiple orders of magnitude higher than it is in the general population. So all of those people thinking, well, they get COVID, but, you know, COVID's not so bad. Well, it is in that population. And therefore, in the data that is accumulating of instances of hospital outbreaks, the mortality rate is quite a bit higher when you catch COVID and you're an inpatient.
Well, and I would think, too, you don't even have to be immunosuppressed. You can, if you're in the hospital, chances are you're sick. And when you're sick, your immune system is already under stress. So
exactly.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about the coronavirus itself, because this is another one of your blog posts this week. COVID-19's other name is SARS-CoV-2. And that would seem to indicate there's a SARS-CoV-1 out there somewhere. And apparently there are quite a few coronaviruses. Tell us what you found.
Yeah. So what I did was just for those people that are interested in knowing more, because the current coronavirus that you mentioned, SARS-CoV-2, won't be the last coronavirus. Coronaviruses are there are tons of different coronaviruses in animals, and particularly in bats. And not all of them are going to be capable of infecting humans, but there's a lot out there that we just don't know. But we do know from sampling that there are many different kinds of coronaviruses. So before the first coronavirus that caused SARS, which stands for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, which is the concept you get of that patient in the ICU needing the intensive breathing help or even going on a ventilator, that kind of thing. The first virus to do that appeared in very late 2002 and early 2003, and it appeared in China as well. And so it occurred in a different part of China, which is more in the southern part of China, but that's also where a lot of these bat caves are and wilder animals. So before that first SARS virus, we actually had been aware of coronaviruses since the 1930s because we had identified them in animals, first in birds and mice, then we detected them in cows, then we detected them in cats. So we've known about them. But the first human coronavirus infection wasn't identified until 1962 and reported in a journal in 1966. And it was when they were sampling medical students in Chicago. And they picked up this new coronavirus. And so that was the first one identified. In 1965, we identified a second one, and that was sampling people with a common cold. So these first two viruses were known and pretty much considered to be common cold viruses. Then in 2003 that I mentioned, we had this first outbreak of SARS. Now, in that outbreak, which it's a very similar coronavirus to the one we're dealing with right now, it spread to, I think, something like 28 countries. Wow. But we got it contained. And the reason that we were able to get it contained appears to be three major factors. Number one, when you got infected with that coronavirus, it made you pretty sick. So it wasn't something that you would be thinking, oh, you know, maybe I'll still go to work, or maybe I'll go to school, or maybe I'll go to this social event. You usually were pretty sick. So that helped reduce the transmission. Second, people took it more seriously because the mortality rate, excuse me, if you got that particular infection was almost 10%. So people took that more seriously. And we were able to contain it. The third factor was it didn't appear to get into animals. And animals can be a reservoir for viruses. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
And those viruses can then get back into the human population. So that was the first one. Then that also that same year, as we began now testing for more coronaviruses, we identified two more coronaviruses that can cause common cold in most people, but could cause serious problems in the elderly and young children. Then in 2012, we had another new coronavirus that causes a SARS-like illness, and that one was called MERS, which stands for Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. And the first case of that was detected in 2012 in a 60-year-old man in Saudi Arabia who had pneumonia, respiratory distress, and kidney failure, and ended up dying. And the mortality rate for those that got infected with that coronavirus was 35%. So one in three people that got that infection would die. And that infection, we determined, was coming from primarily from dromedary camels. And so camels get infected with that coronavirus, and generally they don't get very sick, and they're generally not even visibly ill. And so they get a lot of virus in their nasal passages, and they can spread it from camel to camel. And of course, if humans are interacting with those camels, then they can get infected. So that was 2012. And then, of course, we all know in 2019, we had this new coronavirus. Fortunately, it doesn't cause a severe illness and a high mortality rate, but we've allowed this to go on, whereas we contained the first SARS and even the MERS, although we can still see sporadic MERS cases because it is in an animal now. But with this virus, we've let it go rampant for 3 years, and it infects at least 18 species of animals, and I list those in my blog post. And two of those species, at least, we know can transmit it in a mutated form back to humans. So seems unlikely that this coronavirus is going to go away. We need to make sure that even though everybody has written this pandemic off, that we continue our research into coronaviruses, because odds are we're going to have another pandemic with a coronavirus at some point. Realize that in just the last two decades, we've had three novel coronaviruses that are deadly. So we've got to prepare. We need research into vaccines, antivirals. We need a lot more research to keep going, even though people are ready to move past this.
Dr. Pate, we've got some questions this week. Let's start with Jody. Jody sent us this. I am traveling to Central Asia in July. I have an appointment for a second bivalent booster tomorrow. Should I get it or wait for the new booster coming out in the fall?
Well, that's a great question. I would love to have some more details to help me better advise you. For example, where specifically in Central Asia, if we're talking about something like China, that is going to be a very high risk situation. And I would say, yes, go ahead and get a second booster now. So it depends on where you're going. There's a lot of Asian countries that are still taking way better precautions than we are. It also depends on what are you going to be doing? Are you going to be in high risk situations or not? And it also depends on your underlying health conditions. And the only reason I would consider not getting it just right now is we don't know what the next recommendation is going to be. In fact, we're probably going to get a recommendation coming out in a week or two from the FDA about what we should do with the vaccine. There may be a period of time that you're going to have to wait to get the new booster. So if you're activities here in the U.S. put you at more risk than what you're going to be doing in Central Asia, I might say wait, because you might have to wait longer to get it here. But my guess is you're going to be at more risk there. And especially if you have underlying risk factors, then yes, I would go ahead and get the second booster right now.
And that leads us to, we got an email in just a few minutes ago from Lynn. And since you talked about China being high risk, Lynn wants to know, Dr. Pate, please give us an update on what you know about the resurgence of COVID in China. Is this going on?
Well, it is. And there's a couple things that are alarming. Number one is that a high percentage of cases that we're seeing in China right now are reinfections. Realize that China didn't really have any COVID wave to speak of until the end of 22, because they had one of the most drastic lockdowns of any country. But instead of doing something gradually, they just kind of opened the gates. And so they went from one extreme to the other. So there was a massive number of infections. It's concerning that now we're seeing a high percentage of reinfections already, meaning that, you know, again, people that have previously been infected, yes, there's going to be a period of time that you're going to have relatively increased protection from getting reinfected. It's probably at least 3 months, but I think what this shows is it's probably not as long as 6 months. So you have to be careful. The second thing is that, you know, what you would think is that China would go through kind of a lengthy evolution of variants like we did in our country and other countries that have been more open over the past 3 years. What happened in China is those variants just made the big jump. And so they're seeing the same variants now already in China that we've been seeing in other parts of the world. And we're seeing new variants happen, which is to be expected when you have tens of millions of people getting infected. So China is a real concern right now, and we're watching very carefully.
All right. Sue wants to know, what are some of the short and long-term effects of high-dose steroid treatment?
Okay, so I don't know if Sue's asking in general or if she's asking relative to their use in treating COVID. So let me address the latter first. There were a number of situations when people were first getting COVID. So at this point, I'm talking about that first week of illness. You're not low on your oxygen. You're not severely ill. And there were some doctors that were prescribing a high dose short course of steroids right then, thinking that would help the patients. Fortunately, a few contacted me and I advised them, don't take those steroids. And now the studies have come out showing clearly that if you take steroids early in COVID, that first week before you get low oxygen or severely ill, it worsens your outcome and increases your potential mortality rate. So it is a definite clear no-no. Steroids for COVID are best reserved for if you get sick enough that your oxygen is low, you have to go in the hospital, that kind of stuff. And then the studies have shown we should give the steroids, but we should not give them generally more than about 6 days. And what happened to what we saw, particularly in India, where they were giving high-dose steroids to COVID patients in the hospital for longer periods of time, you got the initial benefit, but then if you continue the steroids, now those people were getting super infections, getting an infection with something else on top of it, and often a really, really nasty a fungus that I've only seen a couple cases on, but it's horrendous. So that's steroids and COVID. Now, steroids in general, they're used for a lot of different things. Generally, in most people, we don't worry about short-term steroids. Short-term, some people do get a sense of kind of euphoria or hyperactivity. It can, if you are a diabetic or have borderline blood sugars, they can throw your blood sugars out of whack. So it can increase your appetite, and some people gain weight. So those things, the long-term steroids are where we really see problems. First of all, it can make you more susceptible to infections because steroids are countering some of your immune responses. Really long-term steroids can cause your body to stop making some hormones that you need to make because it thinks it's already getting it. So you have to be careful and have that monitored by a physician. The other thing is long-term steroids can cause osteoporosis or weak bones. So your doctor needs to be supervising that and giving you treatments accordingly. So those are just a handful of the potential side effects or adverse effects.
You mentioned, I think you were talking about the adrenal gland can be suppressed with high dose.
That's it. Samantha, look at you. You get extra credit.
It's weird because steroids are used for so many things now, whether it's pain management or inflammation, that I think a lot of people aren't aware of some of these effects. You know, even in the short term, you mentioned, but long term can be quite troublesome.
Yeah. And, you know, don't get me wrong. Steroids are a godsend for treating many different conditions. And I have treated hundreds of patients with steroids, but you got to be careful and you've got to make sure that it's supervised by a physician, because done right, it can be a huge help. Not done under supervision, you can get into problems.
Yep. And it's also cheap. It's steroids are cheap. And so they can often be a good medicine. Like you said, do it carefully. Okay. Melissa from Boise wants to know, another long-term, what happens when you are prescribed antibiotics long-term for acne to both the patient and the rest of the system?
So we've talked a little bit before, I think just a few weeks ago, about one of the growing problems that is under-recognized and not getting the attention that it needs in the United States, and that's the growing antibiotic-resistant organism problem. And that one of the many causes of that can be overuse of antibiotics. So much like we just talked about with steroids, you want to make sure that if you're going to have to take antibiotics for a long time, that that is supervised by a physician, because there are things we have to pay attention to make sure that you really, first of all, do you really need them? Because if you don't need them, we don't want you to take them, because you do have this potential for antibiotic resistance. But you also, when you take many different antibiotics, it can change your gut microbiome, which is important. And we're learning more about its defense against a lot of health problems. So when someone does need antibiotics, one thing we always consider is, can it be done topically? In other words, something that you apply. So for acne, we do have some antibiotic options. Same thing for other conditions that are related, like rosacea and so forth. We have some topical antibiotics that might be effective. If you can do topical, that's much better. On the other hand, there are a number of people with really severe skin diseases that do need longer-term antibiotics. And we just have to make sure that we're careful in the selection of that antibiotic and that their treatment course is supervised by a physician.
I think that's very, very good advice. You know, Dr. Payton, you've been writing like crazy. What's next? We've got, I think, about a minute left. What are we going to see next on your blog post?
I think my next one is going to, I'm going to take a little bit of a turn. There's been a lot of controversy about whether physicians should be held accountable for spreading misinformation and disinformation. Some people think that they should be able to do whatever they want under the First Amendment. I am thinking I'm going to write a post about why that's flawed thinking and that, in fact, these physicians should be held accountable. So that's what I'm thinking about.
Wow. That'll be fun. We'll look forward to that. We'll be looking forward to talking about that. And we're also going to get into, in the next couple of weeks, the shortage of physicians and nurses. I think you touched on that, and how hard it is to get in to see doctors. So that's all coming up on the Doctor Roundtable. We've been speaking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System. He's a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. Dr. Pate, thank you so much for your wisdom and your time.
Oh, thanks, Samantha. Good talking with you.
You too. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Samantha Wright. We'll see you tomorrow.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.